Hello, everyone. Welcome to Rash's World. Today, we have a very special guest, Talmadge Boston. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Arash.
Wonderful. So, how would you briefly describe yourself to our audience? Because you're a man of various talents, and I'd be curious to see what would you focus on here in a brief description, in any way you see fit.
Well, I really wear two hats. One, I'm a practicing lawyer for almost 46 years in the Dallas area, specializing in commercial litigation, both trial and appellate. That's my vocation, but my avocation is historian and public speaker and onstage interviewer, but they're all tied to history. I've just released my fifth book. The first two were on baseball history, the third on legal history, and the last two on presidential history. And that's presidential history is definitely where my focus has been the last few years and where I expect it to continue to be. And I come from a family of history lovers and have had a deep affection for presidential history since I was 7 years old.
That's wonderful. And again, various things. I like how you have different interests and it's kind of combining here. And so your latest book is How the Best Did It, Leadership Lessons from a Top Presidents. And so you're looking at eight iconic US presidents, and we're going to briefly touch upon them. But what's interesting is you're looking at their leadership styles, and each of them is unique and what they bring to the table. And more importantly, this is very timely, of how we can learn from it, how it can guide us. So, yes, is that correct, my perception?
Yes, the target audience for my new book is anyone who is or aspires to be a leader in any field of endeavor, running a business, running a law firm, running a nonprofit, running a media company. These leadership traits exhibited by these eight greatest presidents are timeless, and they are applicable to leaders in any fields. And to emphasize the goal to enhance the reader's leadership skills, at the end of each of the eight chapters, I have what I call a mini workbook, a series of questions about the leadership traits for the reader to ask him or herself about the traits that have just been covered in the chapter he or she just read. So it's an attempt to get the reader more actively involved in really the guts of the story in terms of how these great presidents had such success as leaders for the reader to compare him or herself in these traits to the presidents.
Yeah, and you're looking at a wide range of people, which I find fascinating, and it's from both parties, right? So that's important too. It's not just looking at one. So I found it very interesting, this list of famous presidents. And so I also think it's quite interesting to your approach of applied history, and I really like that, because in not that just looking at the facts, these are the facts, this is what happened. In a way, that's kind of boring, but putting it in the context, in like looking at how individuals change history in different ways, to focus on these leaders, and then how in that context, and what can we learn from it? So I want to talk about these various presidents briefly, and see, I have my notes so I can keep up with this. Washington, first president. Now, what are some of the things he started it, basically? He started the American experiment, which was unique in history, which is amazing, right? Especially at those times. And he looked at integrity, inspiring trust, and so on. So these are some of the things you look at. And so how can we apply this his leadership skills to today's world? What can we learn from Washington specifically?
Well, there's several things. Number one, the first trait I go into is the fact that he was so good at learning from his mistakes. He did fight for the British Army during the French and Indian War, but he, in fact, was not particularly successful in his relationship with his superiors in the British Army, who did not give him the promotions and the commissions that he sought. He was a little something of an obnoxious self-promoter during that war, which backfired on him. But thereafter, the rest of his life, no one ever accused him of being a self-promoter, and he rose up the ladder incredibly successfully, to the extent that when he was chosen to lead the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, he was chosen unanimously by the Second Continental Congress. When he was chosen to preside over the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, he was chosen unanimously. When it came time for America to select its first ever president of the United States, he was selected unanimously by the Electoral College. And then for the second term, again, unanimously. So somebody who on four different occasions was chosen unanimously, i.e., had no opponents who were willing to contest his leadership is quite an achievement. And so you say, well, how do you do it? How come no one ever opposed him? Well, one was everybody knew about his heroic deeds. I mean, if you want to establish yourself as being a notch ahead of your competitors, if you've performed heroic deeds and they haven't, well, then you have a huge advantage. And he had been a heroic soldier leader, particularly during the Revolutionary War, which actually went on for 8 years. But ultimately, the American army was outmanned and overmatched, and yet we managed to defeat the British and win the war. That was a huge achievement. And then, of course, at the Constitutional Convention, here you had people from all over the country, many of whom didn't know each other, didn't like each other, didn't agree on things, and yet over a period of a few months, they reached an agreement on a final document, and then they succeeded in having it ratified. And Washington was instrumental in all aspects of getting the Constitution completed and ratified. In terms of, in particular, now we can move on to his presidency. He was a man of unwavering integrity, which meant that every word that came out of his mouth had high credibility. And he also was not a gifted public speaker. He had some issues. One, he had a breathy voice that came from a childhood respiratory illness. So he, in the days long before microphones, he wasn't able to boom with a strong voice for the multitudes to hear. And he also had serious teeth issues, such that during his presidency, he only had one tooth in his head. So he had these incredibly unwieldy dentures, which you can go to Mount Vernon Museum today, where his home was, and see these dentures. And you can't even imagine anybody being able to talk with those things in his mouth. But despite all that, when he spoke, people listened. He, besides these achievements, he had what we call command presence. When he was in a room, you had to notice him immediately. You had to be impressed by him immediately. He was the tallest guy in the room. He was 6'3", which would be like being 6'9" today. He had a piercing eye contact. The portrait artist Gilbert Stuart said that you look in his eyes, you saw the most ferocious warrior in the jungle. He had perfect posture. He always wore perfectly tailored and cleaned attire. He always rode a gleaming white horse. He moved with an athlete's grace. He was a great dancer on the social occasions. He was the best hunter on these hunting trips. So everything he did, he was the best. And he was the most impressive. So when you got all those things going for you, even if you're not a classic powerhouse orator, you make your presence known. But he was an extremely good listener. He was extremely good at making decisions. And the reason was because he made it a point to gather the conflicting viewpoints on a controversial issue and weigh them before he would make a decision during his presidency. When there was an issue that would come up that people would disagree on, he insisted that they send him a written memorandum for him to study before he would ultimately weigh in with the final decision. So these are the kinds of traits that George Washington had that caused him to be so impressive and then so successful, despite the fact that he was not a strong or eloquent public speaker.
Yeah, and it's hard earned. Like, it's the respect is hard earned. Like, it's through reputation, through his lifestyle as well, his demeanor. I think it's a combination of all of those things, as you're saying, integrity as well.
Yeah,
Is it true
they
that they
all.
tried to impeach him? Is that correct?
I don't remember that.
Okay. I believe I saw that in John Mitchum's book, but I want to get to Jefferson as somebody who's also tall, who I know a little bit more about. And so he was I loved his connection with France too. As somebody, I studied French literature. So, and he's like fine dining and all those things. So as a person, I find it quite interesting, but also very hardworking and very open to the freedom of the press. And I was surprised to find out that there were a lot of gossip being printed back then. There was a lot of fake news, if you like, want to use a more modern term about him, but he supported that of the freedom of the press. I think that's hugely important. But what are some other qualities that he also had that we can talk about?
Well, to me, the most important thing about Jefferson is understanding that his immediate predecessor was John Adams, who was a leader of the Federalist Party, along with Alexander Hamilton. They were the two leaders of the Federalist Party. And the opposing party was at the time called the Republican Party, led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. But that party ultimately, over the years, evolved into what's today's Democratic Party. So it's a little confusing to think of them as Republicans, but today that same group would be called Democrats. But be that as it may, during John Adams' presidency, where Adams the Federalist was a president and Congress was controlled by the Federalist Party, they became so upset about the criticism that was coming their way from the members of the Republican Party that Congress passed what was called the Sedition Act, which made it a crime punishable by incarceration for anyone to criticize President Adams or any Federalist policy. So now, fortunately, the Sedition Act, by its terms, expired at the end of Adams' presidency. But that was the country that Jefferson was coming into as a new president, where people had been thrown in jail for exercising their freedom of speech and freedom of press rights to speak their mind on what they thought. So Jefferson knew that if the country stayed divided with this kind of animosity and conduct, belligerent conduct one against the other, that our new nation would not last very long. So in his first inaugural address, in 1801, he at the very beginning said, "Look, folks, we are all Federalists, we are all Republicans, i.e., we are all Americans. We need to start thinking that way, acting that way, or this new nation isn't going to last." Jefferson was also, like George Washington, not a good, effective public speaker,
He was
but
good with words, though, but I guess
he was a great writer. He was an
yeah,
eloquent writer, but he was not a great speaker.
he was in his early 30s when he did the Declaration of Independence.
Right,
So that's amazing of like that kind of mindset at such a young
he
age.
was brilliant, and there's a lot of brilliant people in their 30s. But what made him stand out as an effective president, knowing that he was not a great public speaker? In fact, during his 8 years as president, he only gave two speeches, his two inaugural addresses. But the way he went about breaking down the barriers between the two parties and getting people more inclined to cross the aisle and work together was that he would host dinners
Yes.
two and three times a week for a period of 8 years, where he would gather Republicans, he would gather Federalists, and at these dinners, great food, lots of wine. Jefferson was a dazzling conversationalist. People loved to hear his perspective. He was a Renaissance man. He could speak several languages. incredibly well read, knew his history, knew literature, and got people in a mode of fellowship around the dinner table, and did it not just once a week or once a month. He did it constantly, and over time, you mentioned the John Meacham biography of Thomas Jefferson that you read. He points out over time the walls started coming down, the hostilities were lessened. People realized that there was reasons to like each other, even if they didn't always agree on their politics.
That's it. Right. Yeah.
And so Jefferson was essentially putting into practice two well-known adages about the nature of politics. The first is politics is all about relationships. If you have positive relationships with those you're involved in political issues with, you're more likely to have success. And the reason is the second adage, that is, if somebody likes you, they're more likely to give you the benefit of the doubt. And if they don't, they won't. And so Jefferson got people in a mode of collaboration and cooperation that had not existed at all in John Adams' presidency. And this was really essential and led to his unbelievable success. Not only did he have two terms, but he was followed by James Madison's two terms, who was followed by James Monroe's two terms. Then there was a little window where John Quincy Adams had one term, but then Andrew Jackson, two more terms. So, in a space of 36 years at the beginning of the 19th century, 32 of the 36 years was Thomas Jefferson and his political successors. No one's ever had a political run like that. And so that to me is the thing that stands out most about Jefferson's presidency. The thing that's in second place is that he was what we call a principled pragmatist, in that he obviously was a man of principles, but there was a certain flexibility there when pragmatism and necessity called for it, such that during his second term, all of a sudden Napoleon said he was willing to sell the lands that ultimately became the Louisiana Purchase at an incredibly reasonable price. And Jefferson's first thought was, in reading the Constitution, was, for us to be able to do this is going to require a constitutional amendment, which is a very cumbersome and time-consuming process. And Jefferson soon realized that if he insisted on that principle, that the constitutional amendment was required, then the deal might go away before it could be consummated. So he abandoned this insistence on a constitutional amendment and moved forward and did the deal. And we doubled the land mass of the United States by the acquisition of the Louisiana Purchase area. And that's what great leaders do.
Yeah,
What
he jumped some hoops there. He didn't really follow the law there, but I think that's the flexibility is so important for leaders. And also having a positive relationship with those who oppose your viewpoints. That is so important. You don't want people just to agree with everything you say, right? And that's actually not helpful. So that kind of accepting that and not dealing with it in a positive way.
You know for a fact that no one's ever going to agree. All the people are not going to agree with you all the time.
That is
There
true.
are going to be people who oppose your perspective. And the question is, how are you going to deal with them? How are you going to deal with that situation so that ultimately, hopefully, you can be in a position that the majority will be on your side and you can accomplish your goals. But Jefferson, never underestimate the power of personal charm.
Abraham Lincoln, a good speaker. Now here we have finally a speaker who really impressed. Is that correct?
Lincoln is regarded as our most eloquent speaker and writer. And what's particularly amazing is we're talking about someone who had less than 1 year of formal schooling,
Oh wow, that's amazing.
and yet he ends up the most eloquent ever.
He
He
was also
is,
tall. I mean, that's kind of seems to be a common
well, he
theme.
was tall, but I mean, getting back to his eloquence, he was not only his eloquence, but just his greatness. I mean, he is, most historians rate him as our greatest president ever. He was Theodore Roosevelt's hero. He was Franklin Roosevelt's hero. He was Dwight Eisenhower's hero. And so, he's a Mount Rushmore president. But you say, well, how could somebody who had less than 1 year of schooling be so eloquent? And the answer is, from the time he was a child, he was a serious, passionate reader of great books, great writers, Aesop's fables, Shakespeare's plays, King James Bible, the classic poets. So he was filling his head with the most magnificent, elegant language that anybody had ever put to paper. But then, of course, before he was president, his career had been as a trial and appellate lawyer, which meant he was constantly making arguments on his feet, advocating positions, whether it was to juries, judges, or the Illinois Supreme Court. And that's what I do. And so you talk differently to juries than you do to judges, and you do to appellate courts, than you do to clients, than you do to opposing counsel. And so Lincoln was very careful about choosing his words to fit whoever was on the listening end. And then, thirdly, for his adult life, he was constantly running for political office, which means he was giving speeches all the time. And for him, practice made perfect. So there were all these aspects as a reader, as a lawyer, as a politician that kept him in a mode of communicating and aspiring to make successful presentations, whether in the courtroom or in political elections. But he was also a student of rhetoric, a student of the power of words and what word, and he knew that to come up with a final, as close to perfect product as he was capable of required major editing, many rounds of edits and revisions to come down with a final product in which there was not one unnecessary word and which was 1,000% clear, such that there was no ambiguity or wasn't hard to follow, such that the Gettysburg Address has like 272 words. It took him 2.5 minutes to give his second inaugural address, which ends with malice toward none, with charity for all, regarded as his greatest speech. That was 702 words, took 5.5 minutes to give. So not a wasted word. Every word had meaning. It had, when delivered, it had this incredible rhythm that made it easy to process and grasp and let the words resonate and reverberate and penetrate. So those are the traits that caused Lincoln's word power to be so exemplary.
And he focused on positivity. It was quite optimistic in the darkest hour of, again, American history, again, what was going on. And I think that is so important that it's like really looking for the high road and the better parts of our nature and to follow that instead of, wallow in darkness or pessimism.
Well, I think ultimately what we're talking about there is a trait of being magnanimous, and that is be forgiving, stay above the fray, don't take the bait. And he had his team of rivals, cabinet, some of whom were trying to undermine him. He had Union generals, in particular George McClellan, who was his top general at the beginning of the war, who was an honors West Point grad, who had no respect for Lincoln's capacity to make decisions as commander in chief, although it didn't take long to realize that McClellan, despite his tremendous academic record, was not a good military leader because he didn't like to fight. He didn't like to do battle. He stayed, drove Lincoln crazy. So Lincoln goes to the Library of Congress, reads all the books on military strategy, military history, and finally comes up with a successful battle plan for winning the Civil War. But the main thing here is, here's Lincoln, getting back to leadership. What are your most important goals? Okay. His most important goals were bringing an end to the Civil War, abolishing slavery, and reuniting the country. Well, if you're getting bogged down in petty personality conflicts, whether it's with your cabinet your generals, his wife, who was a very difficult woman. Every day she would wake up and make new enemies and think of ways to tick people off. But he never let any of those people cause him to lose his focus or spend undue amounts of time, trying to grapple with their difficult personalities. He kept his eye on the balls of his big goals, and nothing distracted him. So that was an essential trait that led to his successful leadership during the most troubled time in American history, the Civil War.
Focus here and focusing on your goal, your aims, and continuing with that. That's amazing. And so let's talk about the two Roosevelts and Theodore and Franklin. And what would you say about them? What are some things that
Well, Theodore Roosevelt became president at the youngest age of anyone, age 42.
what's made
He became president when McKinley was assassinated. And Theodore Roosevelt was probably our highest IQ president. He read more books than anybody. Everything he read, he seemed to remember. He wrote more books than any president. He was high energy, overpowering personality, which in many respects was what drove his achieving such a high position at such a young age. He was not recognized as being a particularly great public speaker because everything was always too emphatic. But where he was especially good was as a mediator. Where you have two sides that are in conflict who are not able to solve their own problems. They need a neutral person to come in and to talk through what's at issue, find areas of common ground that they can agree on that can be used as the basis of producing a settlement. And so, 1 year into his presidency, there was this big national coal strike, and half the country was about to freeze to death because there wasn't any coal, and they were incapable of figuring out how to resolve the strike. So no American president had ever gotten involved in a labor strike before. But Roosevelt said, "If I don't do it, then we're going to have half the country freeze to death." And so he did, and he got the sides together, and he finally got them to agree to binding arbitration, and they resolved the issue, and the coal miners went back to work, and then word got out that Roosevelt is an incredibly effective mediator. So Japan and Russia are at war a couple of years later, and they say, "Hey, President Roosevelt, maybe you can resolve our differences." He goes, he does.
Oh, wow.
For
Amazing.
that, he wins the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, yeah.
And then he later does that. There's a conflict in Morocco and another one in the Hague Convention. And so, with this force of personality, with this brilliance of being able to think of possible new areas where they could find common ground and get the sides to become reasonable about settlement, that was one of his great traits. But another related to this was he greatly expanded the scope of the presidency. Like I said, no president had ever got involved in a labor dispute before. No president had taken on public responsibility for our natural resources, our national parks, the need for wildlife refuges, and so forth. So he saw areas that needed addressing. And he took the presidency in those directions, and through the use of what he called the bully pulpit, all those good things came to pass. He left the presidency at age 50, and he died at age 60. The last 10 years of his life were not a success story at all. They were rather a story of almost rapid decline. He had pushed himself at such a high pace for so long that all of a sudden his decision making was impacted, and he didn't make the same good decisions in the last decade of his life that he had led before then. But just a dazzling person. Historians in the most recent polls rank him as our fourth greatest president. Lincoln one, Washington two, FDR three, Theodore Roosevelt four. So a truly great president, and for the reasons I mentioned, traits worthy of being emulated. And of course, his cousin Franklin Roosevelt, elected four different times, carried the country through the Great Depression and World War II. Was hit at age 39 with polio, and yet found a way to prevail over it. Didn't let it stop his political ambitions at all, obviously, and never sought pity. Always tried to make it not apparent that he was not able to walk. His legs were basically useless. But Roosevelt, during the presidency, was a fabulous communicator, an eloquent communicator on the order of Lincoln, not only in terms of oratory to large crowds, but also this conversational style that he used on the radio in his fireside chats that gave people comfort about his decisions and where the country was headed, what the country needed to do. So, an extraordinarily effective public communicator.
And resilient. I mean, that's resilience of overcoming all those setbacks with, again, polio, as well as inspiring everyone. I mean, it's like, I can do this, and I have the human spirit is so powerful. And that's something I look at here at the podcast a lot, that it's we don't realize how powerful the spirit can be in many ways. And he demonstrated it with his actions and
No
with
doubt.
words. Yeah.
No doubt.
What about Eisenhower? And I'm still
Well,
in that.
Eisenhower is a really fascinating, I just mentioned the top four who historians rank. Eisenhower's fifth. And what's interesting is when Eisenhower left the presidency in January 1961, he was succeeded by John Kennedy, who was 43 years old. He was the youngest elected president. Roosevelt became president 42, but not through an election, through a assassination. But here's John F. Kennedy. He had run for president in 1960 against Nixon. He had said, "The country is behind the times. We're losing the space race. There's a missile gap. The Russians have Sputnik and we don't. Eisenhower's too old. He plays too much golf. He's disconnected. He's not energetic. We need a new frontier, et cetera, et cetera." And Kennedy was so charismatic in his presentations that people, for the most part, thought, yeah, there's something there. Well, such that the first presidential ranking poll that came out after Eisenhower left the White House ranked him 22nd out of 34. I mean, the bottom one third. Yet today he's ranked number five. And so you say, how could anybody make that kind of change in evaluations by historians? And the answer is that when he left the president, like all presidents, his papers for a period of time were confidential. And it took a few years, they were opened. Scholars read them. And when they read them, they said, oh my gosh, he was in the big middle of everything. He was the decision maker. He was the guy. And Harry Truman famously said it takes 50 years for the dust to settle in terms of a president's legacy. And it took a while, but people realized, you know what? 8 years of peace and prosperity, which is what Ike had, that's pretty fantastic. And nobody's been able to do that since. Of course, Truman had gotten us into Korea and had no idea how to bring an end to that war. Eisenhower comes in, and within 6 months, we have a truce. During Truman's last few years, we had the Red Scare of McCarthyism. He had no idea how to deal with that. And Eisenhower comes in, and within a year, he comes up with this strategic plan that gives McCarthy enough rope to hang himself, which he does at the Army-McCarthy hearings. And so Eisenhower was an incredibly strategic, effective leader. He was a dazzling organizational leader. He, of course, had been our Supreme Allied Commander during World War II, and he took those skills that had caused us to have such a fabulous war machine and applied them to this White House organization, in his cabinet, in his National Security Council, in his congressional liaison office. And so, getting back to the purpose of the book, Leadership for Businesses, if you are the leader of a large organization and want it to run like a well-oiled machine, read about how Eisenhower ran his administration. It's as good as it gets. And Eisenhower also, in terms of leadership traits, knew when to be patient, as he was with McCarthy in allowing this plan to wipe him out within a period of 1 year, but not trying to do it on his first day in office. In fact, Eisenhower refused to say the name McCarthy publicly. He didn't want anybody to think he was on the same level. He thought McCarthy was in the gutter. He was going to take him out, but he didn't want to act like I'm dealing with an equal, which is how Truman had dealt with it unsuccessfully. But Eisenhower also knew when to play hardball. He played hardball in Little Rock in 1957 in bringing the U.S. Army in to integrate the public schools in support of Brown versus Board of Education. He played hardball in 1956 when England and France and Israel invaded Egypt and took over the Suez Canal against Eisenhower's instructions. And Eisenhower, in order to get them to leave the Suez, drove the British pound down to zero, got UN sanctions, and did what it took for, and refused to provide them with an alternative source of energy. So all these things, he knew when to be patient, he knew when to play hardball, he knew how to lead an organization, he knew how to make decisions with gathering input from the smartest people who were in his cabinet, his National Security Council. So that's why he's ranked number five, but it took a while for people to appreciate that he, in fact, was the person who was making all these good things happen.
I'm also amazed that there are various people in the background too. It's also your cabinet, the people you choose that you want to make sure they are also supporting and helping you in different ways. So that's also, we don't hear much about them, but of course the leader is the one who needs to have a clear vision. And so now I want to look at Kennedy and Reagan. So they inspired people, they motivated people, they brought like energy in many ways. And so it's kind of a different look. So what would you say here briefly to finish up on Reagan?
Well, do you want me to talk about Kennedy or Reagan?
Not Ronald Reagan.
Okay. Well, Reagan came into the presidency after Jimmy Carter's disastrous presidency, where we'd had double-digit inflation, we'd had low economic growth, we'd had high unemployment, we had long gasoline lines. And we had hostages, American hostages, who Jimmy Carter could not get released from Iran. So we had a national state of malaise. And so in came Reagan. And one of Reagan's greatest leadership traits was not only was he this powerful optimist, but he had the power to inspire optimism among the people. And he did that. In how he revived the American economy, he restored America's self-confidence, and he ultimately had a foreign policy that led to the end of the Cold War. And so, yes, that optimism was a big part of that, but also he had long-term vision,
That's important.
and he had the follow-through to effectuate that vision. At the very outset, people said, "Well, what's your foreign policy toward dealing with the communists in the Soviet Union?" He said, "We win, they lose." People said, "Oh, that's flippant, right? You can't possibly think you're going to be able to do that." And he did. And so, but it was a matter of vision. It was a matter of waiting on the right time. He couldn't until Gorbachev came in 1985, did we have a Soviet leader who he could actually do business with. But we came up with this Star Wars technology, which was never actually invented, but it was described, and it put fear in the hearts of the Soviets. And because the Soviet economy was failing, they knew they could possibly come up with technology to compete against Star Wars, and that was instrumental in Gorbachev, backing off of his aggressiveness and ultimately the tearing down of the Berlin Wall and so forth. So Reagan is always going to be remembered for restoring our national self-confidence, not merely through words, but through deeds in uplifting the economy, uplifting our foreign policy to where we had incredible success.
What a wonderful discussion. Thanks so much. It shows how you're passionate with these people. They are part of your life. It feels like you know them, you've known them for a long time. And I'm just excited and thrilled about that because I think focusing instead of just on the events, on these amazing people and what they bring to the table, what they bring to the nation, how they moved the nation forward in different ways, that is amazing. And you consider this book very important in amongst your books. Is that correct?
Well, I think it's important as a matter of history, but I think it's also important, getting back to your observation, as I say in my introduction, applied history. It's one thing to love history, enjoy history. It's something else to be able to apply it to daily living to make you a better leader in whatever area of endeavor you're involved with. So there's a strong instructive component to the book, as well as retelling the high points of the history.
And you want to learn from the best. So, how the best did it? Leadership lessons from a top president, Talmage Boston. You're an author, presidential historian, lawyer. Thank you so much for being on Arash's World. Such a pleasure talking to you.
Same here. Thank you very much, Arash.